Notice at St. Paul, you know, the bookshops, I ran one, and they had that book in the classics section. Tested my humility. Now I've finally attained humility to an heroic degree, so these things are bothering me. I said, "Sister, why did you put me in the classics section?" She said, "Oh, Reverend Mother makes the decisions, and she doesn't like new authors very much, but she said that you write like an author who's been dead a long time." I think I knew what she meant by that. Talking about the curé as a parish priest, and the art of being a parish priest, clearly the greatest of all arts, I can think. Methodist founder John Wesley was asked why he didn't have a parish, and he said, "Well, the whole world is my parish," which is a bit fulsome. But in the case of the curé, his parish was the whole world, and that's true of all our parishes. Like a cell in the body with the DNA, every little cell has encoded in it the whole human fact, and that's true of every parish. Wherever the parish is, rural parish, urban parish, suburban parish, no matter what the size of the parish is, you always have the same microcosm of humanity. You always have the personality types. There's no question about it. I've been in many, many parishes for a long time, and that's like five basic personality types. Every parish has them. Our Lord said that his church would be like a mustard bush, into whose branches all manner of birds gather. Talking about it. Parish has its birds of paradise, peacocks and canaries, but they also have their vultures and cuckoos. And this makes life in the parish easy. But each individual is a unique soul for whom our Lord died. And you always have to remember that. And that's really what moved Vianney. Inestimable value of every soul. He began with only about three people who were practicing the faith. When the Anglican order of St. John the Evangelist, the first monastic order in Anglicanism, was revived in the 19th century, they sent some of the monks over to Philadelphia. Philadelphians had never seen clergymen in their cassocks before. They were wearing simple cassocks, but Quaker lady wrote a letter. They were out on Cherry Street, going back and forth through the church, and she wrote a letter to then the famous Bishop Phillips Brooks, asking him if he was aware that some of his clergy were practicing celibacy on Cherry Street. Well, how does one practice Christianity? And ours, there were only about three people who had any sense of that whatsoever. Why was that? It was because of the time. French Revolution, like some communist revolution, there was a deliberate attempt, and a largely successful attempt, on the part of the government to wipe out the church. Vianney was born in 1786. In 3 years later, he was a farm boy, we know his story, and as a small boy, there were a few priests who went around furtively. They had occupations to pay for their way, like St. Paul, the tent maker, but also to disguise themselves. And Vianney made his first communion in the barn, with farmers standing around keeping watch. We have to remember that Lyon, that he was in a little village called Écouilly, which was a suburb, if you want to use that term, or banlieue of Lyon, that Lyon saw just even maybe worse terror than Paris itself. And one of the head of it, of course, the head of the implementation of the terror was a former Sulpician. He never was in holy order. He was in minor orders. but he had this vendetta against the priesthood. Henri Guénon said that hatred of priests is the telltale sign of an ethnic culture. Of course, we saw that in the French Revolution. Many of the priests fled, all the bishops fled. There were an estimated 800 priests who were put as galley slaves. So a priest was a very rare thing. People had young people growing up without any memory of a priest. Yet he had this, he had his vocation, and he had this sense, but it never really occurred to him until maybe he was in his early 20s that this was really likely, possible that he could be here. But he did have a very good parish, who himself was in hiding, but he cultivated Vianney's vocation. Then when Napoleon came in and there was the Concordat, he was able to go to school. But by that time, he was in his 20s, and he was in what we would call a grade school, 7 or 8 years, very much the same way as Ignatius Loyola. Ignatius Loyola was a young man when he went to elementary school. Students thought that he was thick. Well, they made fun of him because he was older than they were. He would have been there, almost their father. And so they thought he was stupid, and that's something when we talk about being a parish priest, you must remember that that's an exaggeration. He certainly was not stupid. He was very bright, but he had a very hard time thinking analytically, and he had a difficult time with languages, Latin, which was followed. But once he didn't answer the question that the teacher had posed, and the student punched him, said, "You were stupid." Later on, the student said, Obiani knelt to him. He said, "Yes, I am stupid. Would you help me?" And that affected the boy very much, and his name was Loras, and he joined the French Missionary Society eventually as a missionary priest, and he was sent way out into the wilds of Duke, Iowa, where he became a bishop. And it wasn't, his cause was being talked about. Anyway, he finally gets ordained, simply because there was such a shortage of priests. He says his first mass all alone in Grenoble. He carries his cassock with him, goes into the church. One priest volunteers to serve his mass. Now, nobody knew what was going on, knew it was his first mass. And no other parish, the parishes were being restored little by little, but nobody really wanted him. So he went back to his home parish, and he stayed there as curate until the cure, the pastor, died. But he was the pastor was a most inferior man, and that, I think, that example made Vianney, more than anyone else, the parish priest he was. He learned from the parish priest. The world is filled with people telling parish priests how to be parish priests. But the only one who really can do that is the parish priest. People talk about a vocation shortage. I said there's no vocation shortage. I mean, maybe in certain places there's a shortage of priests, but because everybody has a vocation. But as far as I could make out, there are maybe, right now, maybe over 1 billion Catholics who feel called to the papacy. When his cure was dying, he had his discipline, and he asked Gian Vianney to hide it. But he said that if the people saw this, foolish people saw this, they would think I was a saint. But Vianney said he was a saint. So he gets assigned to Ars-Ordange, outside Lyon, and it was so remote. They had their own dialect, their own patois. You have to remember, you know, Lourdes, when Our Lady appeared to Bernadette, she didn't speak French. No, she spoke the patois, which was more sort of Basque. In fact, the parish priest in Lourdes, who did his job well, I mean, he was very skeptical about this. The young girl saying this lady was appearing to her and so on. Well, we have at least a half a dozen reported apparitions of Our Lady in St. Patrick's Cathedral every day, you know, and the Archbishop was very busy if he took them all seriously. He said, well, what did she say to you? And she repeated, did she say it that way?
Yes.
She said it our way?
Yes.
No. And it is a fault, she said. He said, because the Queen of Heaven would only speak. In French of the Empress Eugenie. So when he got there, he had a hard time in the area understanding what the people were saying. And there was a boy, Antoine Gives, he's about 7 years old, who led him to the border of the parish. And of course, that's the famous scene, there's the statue there. And Viennese said to him, you have shown me the road to Oz, I will now show you the road to heaven. Tu m'as montré le chemin d'Oz, je te montrerai le chemin du ciel. And that little boy never forgot that. What did Vianney have with him? He had a little wagon and just some clothes, but mostly books. The books of his old curé. He had about 400 books. Vianney loved books. He had an exaggerated reverence for books. First of all, they were beyond his budget. But it was difficult for him. He had gone much of his early life without any reading. So they were almost magical things to him, and he kept them all his life. So we must never say that, you know, Vianney did not have a life of the mind. In fact, when there were some complaints in the early days from some clergy that he was not a good confessor, he was examined by the diocese, and that, you know, he got an almost perfect score on these test cases, moral cases they had given him. In seminary, he felt, of course, quite out of place, but he was very much wrapped in the tradition of the diocese. This is the eldest see of the eldest daughter of the church. Lyon was the first founded by Irénée, who had come from North Africa. He as a boy, had been taken to hear Polycarp. Old man preached just before Polycarp was martyred. Polycarp told them, including little Irénée, about when he was a child, the parents to hear John the Beloved. Remember John the Beloved describing Easter Day, our Lord coming into the upper room, like all these things. So we're two generations removed, and we are in Lyon. The Archbishop of Lyon, and to this day, it's the primatial see of France. Ex-presidents over Paris, the Archbishop was Cardinal Fesch, who not by coincidence was an uncle of Napoleon. Nepotism in reverse. But as soon as Napoleon was defeated, Fesch fled. All the seminarians were gathered together, including Vianney, to wave goodbye to the Cardinal. But this is, I think, a telling insight into Vianney. He was not naive, but he had always had reverence for his bishop, even if in their personal estate they were not the best. Bishop was the bishop, and Fesch was in and out, according to the fortunes of his nephew. You know that Napoleon had been in exile at Elba, and then he came back. Even in those days, the media were a little fickle. The leading paper of France, the Moniteur of Paris, turned on Napoleon when Napoleon came back. He arrived at Marseille, and the French Paris newspaper said the bandit has placed his foot on our sacred soil. Then he gets up as far as Lyon. General Napoleon enters Lyon. And then a few weeks later, our glorious emperor returned to Paris. That was the cynical climate in which he grew up. Fesch left. If you go to Baltimore, there are two paintings, several paintings, in the cardinal's residence there, for gifts of his art collector. Art grabber. The Vatican would not call Napoleon a great art collector. But there he was waving goodbye to Fesch, waiting for the next theater. And all through his life, Vianney had a very good rapport with the bishops. After all, it was the bishop of Bailly who saw something in Vianney and consented to his ordination. It wasn't simply because there were no other priests. He said he may not be the most learned priest, but he is devout. When he arrived in Ars, the parish was about 250 people, and there were 8 saloons. So figure that out. I mean, they must have gone from one to another. But when they say saloons, you must remember that these were more absinthe. You know, it was like the equivalent of drugs. The people were terribly demoralized because of the Napoleonic Wars, economic conditions. The streets were filled with abandoned children. Even the worst of them, most of them didn't abortion. They would just only days expose the children, and some of them would survive. And Vianney would go along, and he would just see these children lying on the street and in the roads. So when you hear that Vianney shut the saloon, he didn't do that. He was trying what we would now call control prevention programs. The parish, after it was allowed to be open, after Napoleon's exile, was totally derelict. Even during the French Revolution, remember, they had a puppet church, the Gallican Church. The bishop was the Abbé Grégoire. There was an attempt, rather like the Chinese Patriotic Church, to set up something in competition. And the people knew something was wrong. Couldn't put their finger on it. But one woman said she knew that this was not one of the former priests was not a true priest, but he did not make his Thanksgiving after Mass. And the parish had been used for something like a Masonic temple for a little while. It was a very small place. Towards the end of his life, he had a raffle. Vianney was very keen on raffles. He was good at working. And he had a raffle to put up this basilica. And Vianney did not have the best taste in the world. He wanted to do what was right. It wasn't his fault. It was that Romanic, Gallican, Byzantine, Egyptian, which was very popular at the time. Maybe the most successful version of it was Sacré-Cœur in Paris. But you have to remember, St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York was built around that same time. And if they had followed the latest style in architecture, St. Patrick's today would look like the Woman's House of Detention in Greenwich Village. But God bless Bishop Hughes, he said, no, we'll be eclectic, we'll do something more like Cologne Cathedral. That was their base model. And after Vianney died, they were going to take the whole church down, the old church, and replace it with this very grand thing. And it was Pius X. Said, no, keep the old. When you go there, you can see bits of the new church, but the old church is there. And his church really is hardly, seating capacity is not much bigger than the room. Remember that? Really very, very small affair. And one of the previous priests had left the priesthood. Two had died of malarial typhoid and things. It was a swamp. It was a very bad area. And he rang the bell to summon the people, and it just clanked, and it was cracked. And maybe 2 or 3 people showed up. But the local mayor, you know, the smaller the town, the more important the mayor is. And the mayor puts the money there, and he goes to greet the cure, and whatever transpired in the interview, he said to the people in the town, we have a poor church, but a holy cure. So over the period of the next couple of years, he just catechized the people, the very few. Because you remember, and this is something to remember in a parish. We live in a culture which goes by measures, like, you know, according to the chancery or budget and all that kind of thing. Our Lord preached to large crowds, but we don't know how often he preached. Not all that often. Most of the times, I guess, he preached are recorded. But he spent most of his 3 years with the 12. Now, if you take 12, I'm not a mathematician, but you know, when those 12 go out and they get converted another 12 every year, within about 20 years you've got 12 billion people. That's how it works. You have to start with forming the basic core in the parish. That's what he understood. but he excluded no one. He went out, he would stop, he would talk to the farmers, the blacksmiths, and he himself famously said that he'd really learned much about prayer from some of his own people. Well-known story about him talking to that farmer who would go dark in the morning before he went into the field, he would be in church praying, and he asked, how do you pray? How do you pray the way you do? And the farmer's pointed, the vise le bon Dieu ma vise. I just look at the good God and the good God looks at me. And Vianney said, well, that's it. That's it. So there's an example too, you know, the parish priest, he was learning from his people. He was not in any way, once he was talking before about Jansenism, he was not a Jansenist. He knew the dangers of Jansenism. He did, as Monsignor said, he had that certain tinge, but he wasn't imposing like burdens on people the way a Pharisee would. It was just that he himself was so mortified, he just assumed that this was the way, you know, this was the way for people. But there's no evidence at all of him ever being really harsh with anybody who was trying. It was only people who were proud that he could be sharp with. There was one young fellow, rather from a landed family, would come by with his dog, and he just stopped by and he said to the fellow, "What a beautiful dog you have." "Oh, thank you, Jerry. What a pity that your soul is not as beautiful." And eventually that fellow became a Trappist. When he became famous, tourists would come. One day he had come all the way from Paris and took one look at him and was terribly disappointed. She said, "Are you, I had come all the way from Paris to see you. Are you the saint?" And he said, "Well, madam, you are the opposite of the Queen of Sheba." "He came to Solomon expecting too little. You have come to ours expecting too much." he said to a woman, the gossip of the parish, there's personality type 4, whatever. He said, "Madam, you are holiest in February. Why February? Because there's one less day to gossip." One man said to him after he preached one of his catechetical sermons, "Chere, monsieur, you are an ass." And he said, "Well, that is a very good thing. Samson was able to slay 10,000 Philistines with the jawbone of an ass, think, but God can do with the entire beast." So he's always using a correction, but in a docile way. That's not the Jansenist speaking. In fact, he said, "It is easier to deal with the devil than with Jansenists." So he was aware of that problem. As Monsignor Ronald Knox said, that the Jansenists were pure as angels and proud as devils. And that's the one thing that Vianney would not abide. Pride. What's that? That's Christ. Christ, that's how he dealt with the Pharisees. And this comes, of course, very clearly in the confessional. When the priest is in the confessional, he's really doing major surgery. You'll have pious people coming in, taking their devotional confession, and then somebody else there is in the way for 40 years. And you have to give each, you know, the time of the day. I find that in a parish that's very, very difficult, especially when you have a long line of people and somebody chews gum 1 minute into Mass or something like that, and then you have an axe murderer. But you have to give each person the time of day. I was thinking, I was amazed. I tried to figure it up. It's hard to do, but on the basis of a city parish, I estimated, as far as I can figure, I've heard close to 60,000 confessions. I mean, I was astonished by that. Well, it's not easy to do, you know, when you stretch it out. But everyone is different. Now, here's Vianney. You know, he would hear hundreds of confessions later on. Not at the very beginning. Confession was. But he said to one man who was making a rather arrogant confession, you know, sort of, you know, "I've been away 20 years, cursed and that's it," or something like that. Whatever it was. Vianney began to cry. And the man said, "Monsieur, why are you weeping?" "Son, I weep because you do not." A police inspector came, went to confession just out of curiosity. Had apparently not been in some time. He came out weeping that I have seen God in a man. Didn't have that influence. Interestingly, well, we couldn't do this today, but easily. But he has separate confessionals for women and men. Knew psychology, and he knew that men and women were different. That all goes back to the Garden of Eden. There's no news there. It's only the Gnostic who denies that. He could be very, very gracious as well. They said that he would open the door of the confessional for people like Coachman, bow, come in, you know. And of course, he had that gift. I think God gives priests when it's necessary, of reading people's hearts. Sometimes people, you know, think that a priest is miraculous because you know before they say it, but you know, in confessions a long time, that's very supernatural. It's just normal grace. Call it normal grace. I mean, a surgeon very often can look at somebody and tell what's wrong. But Vianney, as a parish priest, knew that he had responsibility for the patient of people, would be accountable for that. First thing he did when he arrived in the parish was to write all the parishioners' names on a ribbon, put it in a metal heart, statue of the Immaculate Heart, and he consecrated all of his parishioners to the Immaculate Heart. Well, I mean, that says about everything you have to say about how he saw people, and it worked. People began to change. After September 11 in my parish, I was sent to my parish without full financial disclosure. And a few more million dollars debt than I knew about. But the first thing we did in the parish was to put, there was a throne for the pastor behind the altar. I figured I have enough to answer for without having to explain to God the judge on why I had preempted him. So I did that, and we put this tabernacle in. Some people said, well, you know, we should be spending money on the mortgage. But the money all came in from all over the place for the tabernacle. And I put the names of, you know, all the people under the tabernacle. And within a year, the mortgage was paid off. Had taken almost 50 years. You know, God, if we help God, he does help us. And that's what he did. He put it all in the heart of Our Lady. And he was perfectly natural about that. And he was talking. Somebody claimed once that, that he saw Vianney in the front of the church between masses, talking to a lady in a blue robe. And Vianney turned around and looked at the person that was being caught, and the figure disappeared. Well, I mean, some of these stories, you know, take legs of their own, but these people said that did happen. He did have great devotion to the Immaculate Heart, to the Sacred Heart. And here he is again. Now he's reviving the piety, the French piety of the Sacré-Cœur, which had been largely lost. In the Archdiocese of New York many years ago, there was a vicar general who was not liked by some of the pastors. That doesn't matter, they. Because the vicar general was considered rather grasping. Somebody died in the parish. He would actually go through the last wills at the coroner's office. And if anybody left money to the parish, the chancery would call up. And one priest was complaining to another about this one day, and the pious response from the other pastor was, well, you know, Monsignor does have his way, but he's a man after the Lord's own heart. Don't tell me he's after that too. We don't know if Vianney got on well, and he entertained clergy, because we know he had a very abstemious life himself, but he always tried to do his best to entertain and put on a good show. When the bishop came, he would eat what the bishop was eating, but he would get sick. But he said there was no attempt, as Monsignor was talking about before, about false piety. But we do know that in the life of the parish priest, in his life instance, there were evidences of clerical jealousy. Because you make the distinction between jealousy and envy. envy is sadness at what another has, and there is, unfortunately, that in clerical ivory sometimes. But jealousy is sadness at being displaced in another's affection. Husband can be jealous because his wife has her eyes on another man. That's not envy, that's jealousy. And I think in amongst the neighboring clergy, most of whom were not well-formed, as I said before, the situation did not lend itself to formation, a good formation in those reforming days. The church was being reestablished, where we are today. You know, we are restructuring things. So much has been lost, we're restructuring it. But people were going from other parishes to the cure. And so they were all trumped up charges about the enemy, and the suspicion went around from the clergy. The entire diocese, all the clergy of the diocese, but they forgot, though, he was on the list. And said that he was incompetent, he was unworthy, he was really not suitable for parish priesthood. And he read it, and he signed it. So the dean or whoever it was who had started this, when he got this with the Annie thing, went and knelt the Annie. And that helped get everybody going. Because there's always that temptation, you know, for parish priests, even though they're Catholic, to be congregationalists. My parish, your parish, or, you know, matching it. But parishes are cells in the organic body of Christ, and the more one helps the other, the more the other helps out. He said that the people themselves were recalcitrant, at least to begin with. They resented what Vianney was doing, and they tried to kick him out of the parish. Slander and making his life difficult, they'd laugh at him. They spread a rumor that he had fathered a child, which was easy to do. I'm not following a child. But there were so many unclaimed children, you know. It was easy to say, oh, this child was actually his. But the one who really wanted him out of the parish, of course, was the devil. And there were infection, different kinds of benefits to the devil. And he had three or four farm boys stationed around the small presbytery, the rectory, at night. Bodyguards, watch out. Devil. He asked them to protect, and then when he told them they were protecting him from the devil, they got a little nervous. But this went on. This went on for about 3 or 4 years. Very hard breaking the ice there. His preaching took two forms: liturgical preaching, but also catechetical preaching. He every morning at 11. Remember, this is a farm community; they could do easily. Well, a lot of our parishes do, I suppose. 11 o'clock in the morning for an hour, he would give a catechetical address to people who came, and to the children. Children didn't have a school really yet, but children would be brought because they didn't have a school. Their parents would bring them. But people, the grown-ups, would listen in through the window. We have to remember that the Jews had, or outside Judaism, the Am Charetz, the people of the land. These were Gentiles who were interested in Judaism. They used to listen inside the windows of the synagogues around the Mediterranean. And some of them were the first converts, for instance, of St. Paul and the other apostles. But it was basic catechism, and he knew. I think Vianney knew that the adults were listening in. They were kind of shy to admit that they didn't know the Ten Commandments or the Seven Sacraments or things like that. So he would talk to the children, but he never talked down to the children. He gave them solid meat and as much as they could digest. And all along with this, of course, he had the providence. He started his orphanage, his housekeeper and two other women, taking care of these orphan children. And that made people realize that he was serious about what he was doing. On later in life, the greatest preacher of the day, Jean-Baptiste Henri Dominique Lamennais, who restored the Dominican order to France, went to ours. He's the curé. The curé asked him to preach. And I think Lamennais was theatrical. He was quite the celebrity preacher. Gave those famous conferences in Notre Dame in Paris. Very theatrical, but solid. On one occasion, he preached right to the wall, stone wall right behind the pulpit, back to the people. He got done. He turned around. He said, "You see, you never listen." So G. Jesus said the stones would cry out. So I'm preaching to the stones and they listen. Well, that had a great impact. But here's Lacordaire, you know, who was listened to by these, all the great people of Paris. Many of them were agnostics. He went down to Arles and he tried to preach and he began to weep. He was so moved. The Annie there, Lemonnier knew that Vianney was a saint. And Vianney was absolutely astonished. He said, how is it that the greatest in science should come to the weakest in science? And he couldn't understand why Lemonnier was weeping. He thought, you know, Lemonnier was sort of disgusted by the church or something. So there again, see, his preaching really was, Newman said, taking that line of Francis de Sales, heart to heart, cor à cor, loquitur. Three times, the devil tried to persuade Vianney that he was wasting his time as a parish priest. The devil knew that he couldn't make Vianney curse God, so he told him he should go to a monastery and become a better Christian. And that happened three times. And twice the people, they were keeping watch on Vianney. He would wait until late at night when everybody would be asleep, and he'd try to sneak out, and they would ring the tocsin, the fire bell, go out and bring him back. The third time he tried that, just cried as they were bringing him back. He said, "Oh, again, they will not let me go." But he said, he told this, that one night he heard a noise, rattling, he went out and there was a large black carriage with black horses and a figure inside motioned to him in the gate, and he took his lantern and I looked and I turned on my heels and thank God I was saved. That's his own testimony. Make of that what you will. So there Vianney is telling us, you know, every time we're tempted to get out of parish, maybe it's that figure in black coach. And that's the left-handed compliment that obeys the priest. Why, you know, why should there be so many problems in the priesthood? Because the priest is the greatest enemy of the devil. There are a lot more Navy SEALs and U.S. Marines wounded than most other people, because they're the ones on the front lines. And Vianney bore witness to that, and that's why he was so successful getting this through to others. One other thing, at the heart of his life, of course, was the altar. And then one thing in the last talk, at the Mass, as things, the Mass be said without affectation, he did pause. His Eucharistic theology was very, very straightforward. That on one occasion, what a great gift this is. I can tell the Lord of the universe this side of the altar to this side of the altar, and I can do that. Isn't it wonderful? Towards the right, at the very end of his last year, he was very feeble, and on Corpus Christi, he almost fell under the monstrance in the outdoor procession. And another priest offered to help him, and the good Lord, who has carried me all through my life, will carry him. Whenever he had money, the first thing he would do, after taking care of the orphanage, would to go into Lyon, which was the silk center world then, and buy vestments, beautiful vestments, wanted everything as fine as could be. Some of them remain to this day. Late in life, he had lost all his teeth, for them. Much industry in the house, and he also didn't have very good nutrition, I think. He did find that people were trying to, when he had a tooth pulled, for instance, buy it and everything. So, to the horror, I think it was the barber, you know, the barber would be the dentist. To the horror, he asked him to pull his other teeth out because he was on his reason. But when he, later in life, he could barely be understood. But he kept saying over, he just pointed to the tabernacle, il est là, il est là, he is there, he is there. And some people in the parish said, we do the cure many, many years, but those were his most eloquent sermons. He practiced personal poverty, but he said we must never make God. Go to ours, you'll see some of the beautiful chalices and the like. And also this was a teaching that he was helping to understand, that he said the king of the universe has come to our humble parish. Anyway, when he died, there were some over 8,000 people at his burial, which was a tremendous thing, especially before all that travel. And the bishop was there, but heading the procession before everyone else was that was Antoine Gilles, who was that seven-year-old boy, at 56 to that. He's the one to whom Vianney had said, "You have shown me the road to Oz, now I will show you the road to heaven, Julie." And one other quote, there was a free thinker, rationalist, in Lyon. When he heard the news that the curé had died, he said, "It is a tragedy for France that this man come to disrupt the 19th century." You have to remember, the 19th century was the modern age. I mean, that was man come of age. They thought, in the 20th century, said man had come of age. Man's always coming of age. Thank you. I think maybe we have some questions.
Thing I remember about John Vianney is he really struggled sometimes with his homilies, like getting his sermons. He would stay up all night trying to write them, and then sometimes he'd be in the pulpit and he'd get halfway through and he'd be like, "It's awful." And he's kind of inspirational for, when I struggle with my homilies, I get an awful homily. Well, John Vianney hasn't been.
Well, and they said that he would be found sometimes asleep with his head on the sacristy, the vesting table in the sacristy, because he'd been all night copying. He was very self-conscious that the more people were coming to him, he didn't want to disgrace God by, he said, his ignorance. That's why he kept reading late at night. And I'm happy to say, as far as I know, he liked reading in bed. He only, he would sleep maybe sometimes just 2 hours a night, because he would hear confessions until 11 at night and be back sometimes at 1 or 2 in the morning. But he liked reading and things in bed because he was just busy. But he copied from those books he brought with him. He had great devotion to the writings of Chrysostom, fathers, and he had no qualms whatsoever about using their sermons. He said that the treasury of the church is given to us to be plundered. Copyright.
Didn't he have a struggle with it? Was it all the priests he lived with?
Yes, that was one of the rare instances in history in which a pastor had a difficult curate. Things were marked by historians. He did have one curate who agreed with some of the dissidents in the parish that he was a very holy man but unsuitable for a parish, so I should take over. And of course, Vianney agreed with him. He took over the curé's bedroom, and the curé sleep in the kitchen until Madame Lasagne, she had a great name, Madame Lasagne, as a housekeeper, she put her foot down and she said, "This will not do." But later in life, the curate came around. In fact, he wrote the first biography of Vianney. But I guess it's for compensation for the way he had mistreated the curé. He wrote this very, in the style of the times, romantic hagiography. And who was very devoted to the curé, because he was a brother, it was a new contemporary figure, and not much was known about him, was John Henry Newman. Now, I mean, two people in external, to say, could hardly be different, more different. But when Newman was dying in the Birmingham Oratory, he asked that a life curé be read to him. That was, of all, Newman was this one of the great minds of all time. The last thing he really wanted to hear was the life of Vianney. And when it was read, he said, "No, stop." He said, "Stop. That does not tell us the man. Thought through the saccharine piety." He wanted to know facts about Vianney. Newman's greatest champion in England, Bishop Ullathorne, Bishop of Birmingham, went on pilgrimage to Oz, spent several days there. Oh, I mean, they were like a tent city. people, well, you have to wait a week or so to have your confession heard. And he saw all that, he described that. So it may have been Ullathorne who passed this on to Newman. And that's to Newman's credit too, because Ullathorne was a very different man from Newman. I mean, Newman was a very sensitive man, a man almost hyper-refined in the late Regency Victorian way. I mean, if you told the most innocent puns, the silly, he would blush. Right? He just very sensitive. And Ullathorne was just the opposite. He started off as a cabin boy in the Royal Navy. You can imagine what that life was like. And he had salty pressures all his life. And in fact, it always amused me that he and Newman got on so very well. But he was a man of real piety, genuine piety. Nothing affected. He had his chaplain anoint him. When he received the last rite, when Ullathorne was dying, the chaplain anointed him. And he finished the whole thing. And he had a kind of cockney accent, the Archbishop. He said, "Are you finished now?" "Yes, Your Excellency." "Good. Now the devil can go kiss my arse." And those were his dying words. They may have made Newman blush, but I think Newman would have said it was also very sound dogmatic theology. Okay. That's it.
Next activity is a snack at 9.
If anyone wants to see me for payment,
I did.
No, I'm not trying to get double dipping.